Nobody thinks in terms of human beings. Governments don't, so why should we? They talk of the people and the proletariat, and I talk of the mugs. It's the same thing. They have their 5-year plans, and so have I. You used to be a Catholic. Oh, I still believe, old man, in God and mercy and all that. I'm not hurting anybody's soul by what I do. The dead are happier dead. They don't miss much here, poor devils, he added, with that odd touch of genuine pity as the car reached the platform and the faces of the doomed-to-be victims, the tired, pleasure-hoping Sunday faces, peered in at them. I could cut you in, you know. It would be useful. I have no one left in the inner city. Except Kula and Winkler. You really mustn't turn policeman, old man. They passed out of the car, and he put his hand again on Martin's elbow. That was a joke. I know you won't. Have you heard anything of old Bracer recently? I had a card at Christmas. Those were the days, old man. Those were the days. I've got to leave you here. We'll see each other sometime. If you're in a jam, you can always get me at Kurtz's. He moved away, and, turning, waved the hand he had had the tact not to offer. It was like the whole past moving off under a cloud. Martin suddenly called after him, "Don't trust me, Harry." But there was too great a distance now between them for the words to carry. Anna was at the theatre, Martin's told me, for the Sunday matinee. I had to see the whole dreary comedy through a second time. About a middle-aged composer and an infatuated girl and an understanding, a terribly understanding wife. Anna acted very badly. She wasn't much of an actress at the best of times. I saw her afterwards in her dressing room, but she was badly fussed. I think she thought I was going to make a serious pass at her all the time, and she didn't want a pass. I told her Harry was alive. I thought she'd be glad and that I would hate to see how glad she was. But she sat in front of her makeup mirror and let the tears streak the grease paint, and I wished afterwards that she had been glad. She looked awful, and I loved her. Then I told her about my interview with Harry, but she wasn't really paying much attention, because when I'd finished, she said, "I wish he was dead." "He deserves to be," I said. "I mean, he would be safe then, from everybody." I asked Martins, "Did you show her the photographs I gave you, of the children?" "Yes. I thought it's got to be kill or cure this time. She's got to get Harry out of her system. I propped the pictures up among the pots of grease. She couldn't avoid seeing them. I said, the police can't arrest Harry unless they get him into this zone, and we've got to help. She said, I thought he was your friend. I said, he was my friend. She said, I'll never help you to get Harry. I don't want to see him again. I don't want to hear his voice. I don't want to be touched by him, but I won't do a thing to harm him. I felt bitter. I don't know why, because, after all, I had done nothing for her. Even Harry had done more for her than I had. I said, you want him still, as though I were accusing her of a crime. She said, I don't want him, but he's in me. That's a fact, not like friendship. Why, when I have a sex dream, he's always the man. I prodded Martins on when he hesitated. Yes. Oh, I just got up and left her then. Now it's your turn to work on me. What do you want me to do? I want to act quickly. You see, it was Harbin's body in the coffin. So we can pick up Winkler and Kula right away. Kurtz is out of our reach for the time being, and so is the driver. We'll put in a formal request to the Russians for permission to arrest Kurtz and Lime. It makes our files tidy. If we are going to use you as our decoy, your message must go to Lime straight away, not after you've hung around in this zone for 24 hours. As I see it, you were brought here for a grilling almost as soon as you got back into the inner city. You heard then from me about Harbin, you put two and two together, and you go and warn Kula. We'll let Kula slip for the sake of the bigger game. We have no evidence that he was in on the penicillin racket. He'll escape into the second berserk to Kurtz, and Lime will know you've played the game. 3 hours later, you send a message that the police are after you. You're in hiding and must see him. He won't come. I'm not so sure. We'll choose our hiding place carefully, where he'll think there's a minimum of risk. It's worth trying. It would appeal to his pride and his sense of humour if he could scoop you out, and it would stop your mouth. Martin said, "He never used to scoop me out at school." It was obvious that he'd been reviewing the past with care and coming to conclusions. "That wasn't such serious trouble, and there was no danger of your squealing." He said, "I told Harry not to trust me, but he didn't hear. Do you agree?" He had given me back the photographs of the children, and they lay on my desk. I could see him take a long look at them. "Yes," he said. "I agree." All the first arrangements went according to plan. We delayed arresting Winkler, who had returned from the second Berserk, until after Kula had been warned. Martins enjoyed his short interview with Kula. Kula greeted him without embarrassment and with considerable patronage. "Why, Mr. Martins, it's good to see you. Sit down. I'm glad everything went off all right between you and Colonel Calloway. A very straight chap, Calloway." "It didn't," Martins said. "You don't bear any ill will, I'm sure, about my letting him know about you seeing Koch. The way I figured it was this. If you were innocent, you'd clear yourself right away. And if you were guilty, well, the fact that I liked you oughtn't to stand in the way. A citizen has his duties." "Like giving false evidence at an inquest?" Kula said, "Oh, that old story. I'm afraid you were riled at me, Mr. Martins. Look at it this way. You, as a citizen, owing allegiance, the police have dug up the body. They'll be after you and Winkler. I want you to warn Harry." "I don't understand." "Oh, yes, you do." And it was obvious that he did. Martins left him abruptly. He wanted no more of that kindly, humanitarian face. It only remained then to bait the trap. After studying the map of the sewer system, I came to the conclusion that a café anywhere near the main entrance of the great sewer, which was placed, like all the others, in an advertisement kiosk, would be the most likely spot to tempt Lyme. He had only to rise once again through the ground, walk 50 yards, bring Martins back with him, and sink again into the obscurity of the sewers. He had no idea that this method of evasion was known to us. He probably knew that one patrol of the sewer police ended before midnight, and the next did not start till 2. And so, at midnight, Martin sat in the little cold café in sight of the kiosk, drinking coffee after coffee. I had lent him a revolver. I had men posted as close to the kiosk as I could, and the sewer police were ready when 0 hour struck to close the manholes and start sweeping the sewers inwards from the edge of the city. But I intended, if I could, to catch him before he went underground again. It would save trouble and risk to Martins. So there, as I say, in the café, Martins sat. The wind had risen again, but it had brought no snow. It came icily off the Danube, and in the little grassy square by the café it whipped up the snow like the surf on top of a wave. There was no heating in the café, and Martins sat warming each hand in turn on a cup of ersatz coffee, innumerable cups. There was usually one of my men in the café with him, but I changed them every 20 minutes or so, irregularly. More than an hour passed. Martins had long given up hope, and so had I, where I waited at the end of a phone several streets away, with a party of the sewer police ready to go down if it became necessary. We were luckier than Martins because we were warm in our great boots up to the thighs and our reefer jackets. One man had a small searchlight, about half as big again as a car headlight, strapped to his breast, and another man carried a brace of Roman candles. The telephone rang. It was Martins. He said, "I'm perishing with cold. It's 1:15. Is there any point in going on with this?" "You shouldn't telephone. You must stay inside. I've drunk 7 cups of this filthy coffee. My stomach won't stand much more." "He can't delay much longer if he's coming. He won't want to run into the 2 o'clock patrol. Stick it another 1/4 hour, but keep away from the telephone." Martin's voice said suddenly, "Christ, he's here! He's..." And then the telephone went dead. I said to my assistant, "Give the signal to guard all manholes." And to my sewer police, "We're going down." What had happened was this. Martins was still on the telephone to me when Harry Lyme came into the café. I don't know what he heard, if he heard anything. The mere sight of a man wanted by the police and without friends in Vienna speaking on the telephone would have been enough to warn him. He was out of the café again before Martins had put down the receiver. It was one of those rare moments when none of my men was in the café. One had just left, and another was on the pavement about to come in. Harry Lyme brushed by him and made for the kiosk. Martins came out of the cafe and saw my man. If he had called out then, it would have been an easy shot. But I suppose it was not Lyme, the penicillin racketeer, who was escaping down the street. It was Harry. Martins hesitated just long enough for Lyme to put the kiosk between them. Then he called out, "That's him!" But Lyme had already gone to ground. What a strange world, unknown to most of us, lies under our feet. We live above a cavernous land of waterfalls and rushing rivers, where tides ebb and flow, as in the world above. If you have ever read the adventures of Alan Quatermain, and the account of his voyage along the underground river to the city of Milosis, you will be able to picture the scene of Lyme's last stand. The main sewer, half as wide as the Thames, rushes by under a huge arch, fed by tributary streams. These streams have fallen in waterfalls from higher levels, and have been purified in their fall, so that only in these side channels is the air foul. The main stream smells sweet and fresh, with a faint tang of ozone, and everywhere in the darkness is the sound of falling and rushing water. It was just past high tide when Martins and the policeman reached the river. First the curving iron staircase, then a short passage so low they had to stoop, and then the shallow edge of the water lapped at their feet. My man shone his torch along the edge of the current and said, "He's gone that way." For just as a deep stream, when it shallows at the rim, leaves an accumulation of debris, so the sewer left in the quiet water against the wall a scum of orange peel, old cigarette cartons and the like. And in this scum, Lyme had left his trail as unmistakably as if he had walked in mud. My policeman shone his torch ahead with his left hand and carried his gun in his right. He said to Martins, "Keep behind me, sir. The bastard may shoot." "Then why the hell should you be in front?"
"It's my job, sir."
The water came halfway up their legs as they walked. The policeman kept his torch pointing down and ahead at the disturbed trail at the sewer's edge. He said,
"The silly thing is, the bastard doesn't stand a chance. The manholes are all guarded, and we've cordoned off the way into the Russian zone. All our chaps have to do now is to sweep inwards down the side passages from the manholes."
He took a whistle out of his pocket and blew. And very far away, here and again there, came the notes of a reply. He said,
"They're all down here now. The sewer police, I mean. They know this place just as I know the Tottenham Court Road. I wish my old woman could see me now," he said, lifting his torch for a moment to shine it ahead.
And at that moment the shot came. The torch flew out of his hand and fell in the stream. He said,
"God blast the bastard! Are you hurt?" "Scraped my hand, that's all. A week off work. Here, take this other torch, sir, while I tie my hand up. Don't shine it. He's in one of the side passages."
For a long time, the sound of the shot went on reverberating. When the last echo died, a whistle blew ahead of them, and Martin's companion blew an answer. Martin said,
"It's an odd thing. I don't even know your name."
"Bates, sir."
He gave a low laugh in the darkness.
"This isn't my usual beat. Do you know the Horseshoe, sir?"
"Yes."
"And the Duke of Grafton?"
"Yes."
"Well, it takes a lot to make a world."
Martin said, "Let me come in front. I don't think he'll shoot at me, and I want to talk to him."
"I had orders to look after you, sir. Careful."
"That's all right."
He edged round Bates, plunging a foot deeper in the stream as he went. When he was in front, he called out, "Harry," and the name sent up an echo. "Harry, Harry, Harry," that travelled down the stream and woke a whole chorus of whistles in the darkness. He called again, "Harry, come out, it's no use." A voice, startlingly close, made them hug the wall.
"Is that you, old man?" it called. "What do you want me to do?"
"Come out and put your hands above your head."
"I haven't a torch, old man. I can't see a thing."
"Be careful, sir," Bates said. "Get flat against the wall. He won't shoot at me," Martin said.
He called,
"Harry, I'm going to shine the torch. Play fair and come out. You haven't got a chance."
He flashed the torch on, and 20 feet away, at the edge of the light and the water, Harry stepped into view.
"Hands above the head, Harry."
Harry raised his hand and fired. The shot ricocheted against the wall a foot from Martin's head, and he heard Bates cry out. At the same moment, a searchlight from 50 yards away lit the whole channel, caught Harry in its beams, then Martin's, then the staring eyes of Bates slumped at the water's edge, with the sewage washing to his waist. an empty cigarette carton wedged into his armpit, and stayed. My party had reached the scene. Martin stood dithering there above Bates's body, with Harry Lyme halfway between us. We couldn't shoot for fear of hitting Martin's, and the light of the searchlight dazzled Lyme. We moved slowly on, our revolvers trained for a chance, and Lyme turned this way and that like a rabbit dazzled by headlights. Then, suddenly, he took a flying jump into the deep central rushing stream. When we turned the searchlight after him, he was submerged, and the current of the sewer carried him rapidly on past the body of Bates, out of the range of the searchlight, into the dark. What makes a man without hope cling to a few more minutes of existence? Is it a good quality, or a bad one? I have no idea. Martins stood at the outer edge of the searchlight beam, staring downstream. He had his gun in his hand now, and he was the only one of us who could fire with safety. I thought I saw a movement, and called out to him, "There, there, shoot!" He lifted his gun and fired, just as he had fired at the same command all those years ago on Brickworth Common, fired as he did then, inaccurately. A cry of pain came tearing back like calico down the cavern. A reproach, an entreaty. "Well done," I called, and halted by Bates's body. He was dead. His eyes remained blankly open as we turned the searchlight on him. Somebody stooped and dislodged the cotton and threw it in the river, which whirled it on, a scrap of yellow gold flake. He was certainly a long way from the Tottenham Court Road. I looked up, and Martin's was out of sight in the darkness. I called his name, and it was lost in a confusion of echoes in the rush and the roar of the underground river. Then I heard a third shot. Martin's told me later. I walked downstream to find Harry, but I must have missed him in the dark. I was afraid to lift the torch. I didn't want to tempt him to shoot again. He must have been struck by my bullet just at the entrance of a side passage. Then I suppose he crawled up the passage to the foot of the iron stairs. 30 feet above his head was the manhole, but he wouldn't have had the strength to lift it. And even if he had succeeded, the police were waiting above. He must have known all that. But he was in great pain, and just as an animal creeps into the dark to die, so I suppose a man makes for the light. He wants to die at home, and the darkness is never home to us. He began to pull himself up the stairs, but then the pain took him, and he couldn't go on. What made him whistle that absurd scrap of tune I'd been fool enough to believe he had written himself? Was he trying to attract attention? Did he want a friend with him, even the friend who had trapped him? Or was he delirious, and had he no purpose at all? Anyway, I heard his whistle, and came back along the edge of the stream, and felt where the wall ended, and found my way up the passage where he lay. I said, "Harry," and the whistling stopped just above my head. I put my hand on an iron handrail and climbed. I was still afraid he might shoot. Then, only 3 steps up, my foot stamped down on his hand, and he was there. I shone my torch on him. He hadn't got a gun. He must have dropped it when my bullet hit him. For a moment I thought he was dead, but then he whimpered with pain. I said, "Harry," and he swiveled his eyes with a great effort to my face. He was trying to speak, and I bent down to listen.
"Bloody fool," he said.
That was all. I don't know whether he meant that for himself, some sort of act of contrition, however inadequate. He was a Catholic. Or was it for me, with my 1,000 a year taxed and my imaginary cattle rustlers, who couldn't even shoot a rabbit clean? Then he began to whimper again. I couldn't bear it any more, and I put a bullet through him. "We'll forget that bit," I said. Martin said, "I never shall." A thaw set in that night, and all over Vienna the snow melted, and the ugly ruins came to light again, steel rods hanging like stalactites, and rusty girders thrusting like bones through the grey slush. Burials were much simpler than they had been a week before, when electric drills had been needed to break the frozen ground. It was almost as warm as a spring day when Harry Lyme had his second funeral. I was glad to get him under earth again. But it had taken 2 men's deaths. The group by the grave was smaller now. Kurtz wasn't there, nor Winkler. Only the